All right, so welcome everybody. Looks like maybe Clubhouse was having some server issues, which I guess is bad and good. They're growing. So given that we had a late start on this, it would be great if all of you could share this, use the share button below, share it to Clubhouse, share it to others. Please help me ping some people into the room. And we will get started. So I'm going to invite some people up on the stage. We have our founder here, David Kelly. Lawrence, did you have a question for Richard?
I did. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Lord.
I had a question. This is actually about an article that you had written, I think another week or two back for AIER about rent selling countries and corruption. And I was reading through it and I was curious, you used cronyism as your definition there. And I know that, when we come to these words, I sometimes get them confused in my own head. There's cronyism, and then some people say crony capitalism, and then other people say, well, no, those two aren't the same. So I was wondering if you could maybe give a little bit of clarification on those terms.
Yeah, I would be glad to. The relevant essay, as you mentioned, is at AIER. So if you just put Salzman at AIER, that's the acronym for the group, American Enterprise for Economic Research, American Institute for Economic Research. Yeah, the first thing, Lawrence, to note is that rent seeking or rent selling, which is in the literature, rent does not mean apartment rents. Rents to an economist means an abnormal profit or gain, but particularly related to some kind of favoritism, some kind of political favoritism. So the literature, however, the reason I wrote this and the reason I'm focusing on it and I'm preparing a more academic journal article on it is 90% of the discussion is on rent seeking. In other words, it indicts the private sector for lobbying what's presumed to be, an otherwise selfless public servant, the government, for favors. And my focus is on rent selling, namely a mixed economy by its nature creates rents, creates favors, franchises, monopolies, all the things Ayn Rand talked about. And so the origin of corruption or cronyism isn't on the private sector side, but on the government side, but particularly a type of government that abandons the rule of law, abandons equal treatment before the law. If you think about it, it's precisely unequal treatment, disproportionate treatment, call it discriminatory treatment, that invites lobbying. Just as an obvious example, if you had a tax rate that was the same for everyone, of what's called a flat tax, say 10%, there would be no reason to lobby the government for tax breaks because everyone has the same tax rate. But if the wealthiest pay 80% and the middle class pays 50%, and then the lower groups pay 20%. Well, now you invite people trying to get that 80% rate down, either by tax credits or what. And precisely, they are the richest and the wealthiest, most likely to be able to do so. Now, you're right on the terminology. The way we would put it is, crony capitalism is a contradiction in terms. Why? Because capitalism, by our view of it, is equal treatment before the law. Now, unfortunately, the standard definition of capitalism out there is that it's a political economic system for the benefit of capitalists. See, they cannot conceive, this is the Marxist theory, actually, they cannot conceive of any kind of government that isn't in the pay of some kind of group. In Britain, they have the Labour Party. The idea of a subgroup, having a political party, it's a very common view. We need to push back and resist that. By the way, etymologically, this may sound weird, but the whole concept of crony capitalism didn't start until 1980. So it's a very recent term. It showed up in a Time magazine article, actually, about the Philippines. And the Philippines were corrupt, under, oh, I forget his name now, Marcos. And what's interesting is the word crony actually comes from the British university system, crony coming from chronological or time. Crony meant a long-term friend, and cronyism in Britain meant over the course of your career, benefiting or hiring or staying in touch with friends. But when it was combined with political corruption, it was the idea that government's role was to help friends. So you could think of cronyism as extended nepotism. Nepotism, of course, is favoritism to family members. And if you extend the family members to friends, now it becomes cronyism. But it really, in the mixed economy, is favors not just to family members or friends, but to pressure groups. And the pressure groups themselves, of course, are a phenomenon of the mixed economy. So I hope that helps. I use in that essay cronyism and a related term, corruption and favoritism, almost interchangeably. But I hope that helps.
It does. Thank you very much.
All right. David, I'm seeing that you don't have a mute button on, so I am worried that you may need to sign out and sign back in, unless you can try to speak up. Otherwise, wanted to see if Scott or Professor Jason Hill, if you had a question for Richard.
I'll just pop in real quick with thoughts on the economy, the market. Even Bitcoin hasn't been an inflation hedge, but just more about the market and the economy.
Well, I believe the combination of the anti-energy policy, which Biden started almost right away, closing down pipelines and other things, that plus threats of higher tax rates, that plus, I think this surprised people. It didn't surprise me so much. The one Trump policy he did not immediately reverse was a tariffs. So there are still 25% tariffs on imports. So it, negative in the sense of the market, I believe, expected him to reverse those, and he hasn't. But I really think in the Na if you look at the numbers, the NASDAQ, I think, is down 30%, the S&P down 17, 18% the last time I checked. The economy contracted in the first quarter. So things are going badly. But the more recent phenomenon, I think, that's just really hurting the economy is the possibility of the U.S. going to war. Now, I think the U.S. is actually at war. It just approved a $40 billion package for Ukraine, half of it military. So, in effect, I think the market is trying to figure out whether this will expand into a wider war. And I think the Biden administration does want that, but they don't want to be explicit about it. Countries do, when they don't know what they're doing, do stumble into wars. That does happen historically. This is what the markets are trying to figure out. All else equal, if this was just a normal situation of recovering from 2 years of COVID and the COVID lockdowns, the economy should be recovering. And it was actually in the year or half year or so before Biden got in. The Biden policies are just thoroughly anti-capitalist on every level. More regulation, explicitly saying we're going to get rid of fossil fuels, almost gleeful that the oil price is up, because they're and the gasoline price, So instead of saying, well, this is a problem to be cured, they're languishing it, they're loving it on the grounds. This is a wonderful opportunity, they say, to shift into what Alex Epstein calls the unreliables, wind and solar and whatnot. So there is a kind of gleeful destructiveness about the Biden policies that the markets are trying to absorb as well, I believe. So that's my take. I mean, as to the future, I think I'm not actually sure the Republicans will do well in the midterm elections. So that's a relevant thing. If you think the markets will improve because of that, I'm not so sure about that. But I have a hard time believing that the economy will become robust anytime in the next 2 or 3 years if this policy continues.
All right. Thanks for that, Richard. Jason, are you just
Hi,
keeping us
Rich.
company?
No, I have a question I wanted to ask
Hi,
Richard.
Jason. Hey,
Hi,
how you
Rich.
doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. So Rob just came out with his book, which I just ordered on on history, which is a very, you know, positive view on the things that have gone right in history and the things that we should be celebrated. Ayn Rand, when you read from the early Ayn Rand to the journals to the letters of Ayn Rand to her essays, I don't think from the minute she landed in the United States that she was ever satisfied with the culture. I mean, she called the culture bankrupt, that it was in her 1978 Ford Hall Forum lecture on a cultural update. She said the culture was not only was not militantly bankrupt, it was routinely bankrupt. In the 1966 lecture at the Ford Hall Forum, she had an essay, a talk called "Our Cultural Value Deprivation."
Deprivation, yeah.
She always thought that, I don't think there was ever a moment in her life where she was ever satisfied with the culture. The culture was always bankrupt and so on. And then Rob comes out with this book that I'm eager to read. My question, so there are these two polar opposite views of looking at, they need not be irreconcilable. I guess my question for you is, what do you see as the almost nearly dangerously irreversible trend in our culture today that is just bad for our culture? I mean, we look out and we see a lot of things. You talked about the regulations from the Biden administration, the cancellation of fossil fuel. We look at trans ideology. We look at woke culture. What do you think is the most dangerously irreversible, either set of trends or one trend that could either contribute to the, if one ascribes to the declinist philosophy that we face in America today?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I'm fit to answer it, but I have a couple thoughts. First of all, the polar nature of what you're talking about, I've noticed as well. My take on this is that optimism is, put it this way, if the theory is that philosophy moves history, let's stipulate that, and that good philosophy will lead to good results, there are lags. There's a lag time, you know, between from the philosophers, the intellectuals, to the, and the techno, call it the economic technological wonders that we're seeing today, we would agree is a manifestation, a residual of past enlightenment period and rule of law. But if you look at the philosophy now, though, it's pretty bad. And so we would project outward that in time, the technological slowdowns will occur. I mean, in Atlas Shrugged, it's not just technological slowdown or stagnation, it's collapse. It's eroding. It's people fall. It's bridges collapsing and blackouts and things like that. And that could happen. And the puzzle to people would be, hey, we know how to do electricity. Why is it collapsing? Yeah, because people hate fossil fuels. It isn't an issue of we don't know the technology anymore. So I haven't read Rob's book, but the optimism I see in people like Steven Pinker and others, where the data sets are, they are real data sets. There's no doubt about it. Julian Simon, same thing. The late Julian Simon used to issue books about how everything's getting better, standards of living, things like that, eradicating diseases. True, 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 true. But if it's a trailing effect of Enlightenment ideas from the 1700s, 1800s, then with a lag, then we have something to worry about, because the coming century will not be so good technologically. But it's interesting what you name, like if I were to, in terms of fields or areas, in terms of irreversibility, I wouldn't say it's a total irreversibility, but I see what you're saying, Jason. If it's the kind of thing that it's like a point of no return, that there's these tipping points, and if something gets so bad, it's hard to revive it. If I were to name what that is, I wouldn't name what a typical economist would say. Sometimes they'll say the monetary system is too far gone. The fiscal profligacy is too far gone. You know, we're ultimately going to go financially bankrupt. And the hatred of energy. I don't think those are bad, but I would name schooling. I would name education. I think the most worrisome thing to me is whether the universities, the school systems, you and I are in this, you and I and Stephen Hicks and others, That worries me most, that it is so bad that I don't know how that's reversible. And I mean, I heard you to say one time in recent months, the universities are gone. I mean, I think they are mostly gone. We're in it, so we can't say it's totally gone because there are pockets of rationality and enlightenment. But I would say that one, and even things like homeschooling, private schools, alternative universities, we are beginning to see those. But and that's good. But those are, to me, those are not to be negative about those. They're so small relative to the hordes of students coming out of Ivies and elsewhere, which hate capitalism, reason, and egoism. That's the one that worries me most, not these more economic ones like monetary energy or otherwise. What do you think, Jason? I'm curious what I'd love to hear what you think on this as well.
Oh, I totally agree with you. I mean, I've been writing on this, you know, as you know, for a long time, calling our universities cults, national security threats, producers of enemies of the state, and as the conveyor belt of villainy, really, because they are, Rand was right, the intellectuals and the universities are the transmission belt of culture. Mm-hmm. And so all the extent to which cultural relativism has been elevated to the level of a national cult, an ethical relativism, really, and the attack on reason and logic as the constructs of racist white imperialist men and as not proper adjudicators among disputing truth claims, but rather the primacy of feelings and emoting as justification for truth. So I definitely think both the K through 12 and the academy, but the academy really, because the universities are the training grounds for the teachers, the education, especially the education departments in the universities are the training ground for the teachers who teach these kids from K through 12. So I completely agree with you wholeheartedly on that. I think that's a very, very worrisome, vexing.
And Jason, I used to think this phenomenon does occur in other fields. I used to think, and I think others did, that a field can so hurt itself and kill itself that it becomes impotent and irrelevant. I remember in the 80s and 90s, people used to say, okay, so the universities are gone, but at least we have, you know, think tanks and alternative this and alternative that. But I don't see that. I think there are alternatives, but the universities still have an enormous influence. And one way I would put it is on the woke thing you mentioned. I think 20 years ago, if you ask people, where's the wokeness? They would say in the universities, a little bit in Hollywood, a little bit in the media. Okay, so those are three institutions. But if you look now, it's in C-suites, it's in corporate suites, it's in the Pentagon, it's in public schools, it's at Disney, it's at, you know what I'm saying? And I think to myself, there's no way it could spread into every other field had it not come from the universities. Because they're the ones, I mean, they're training business school, they have business schools, they have the same kind of thing going on in business schools. So that's another, I think, point to show the power of the universities, in this case for ill, but the kind of spreading cancer that it would get into every institution means that it's this more fundamental level of the universities.
And just one last thing. When you see a corporation like Coca-Cola having as part of its mission statement the decentering of whiteness, which is a total anti concept, right, and meaning, you know, be less certain, be less arrogant, implicit also understanding is be less punctual, just a sort of nonsensical set of mandates. You know that there's no lower place to go in terms of moral depravity that's coming out of the universities. Yeah.
Agreed. Thank you, Jason.
All right. I'd love to hear from David. And I just want to, two things. One, remind all of you who are in the room, please raise your hand. We'll bring you up on stage to ask a question, really, of any of our scholars. And we have four scholars in the room, Professor Salzman, Professor Hill. We have, of course, our founder, David Kelly, and Professor Stephen Hicks. So please share this room, ping people into it. I want to make sure as many people as possible have the opportunity to join in the discussion. So, David.
Thanks, Jag, and thanks, Richard and Jason, for that, raising this topic. I just want to make a point. I've been aware of and thought about and concerned about the same, you know, polarity or dichotomy that you have of watching the culture decline while, you know, some great things are happening. And, you know, both in science, if you think about all the vast increase in knowledge and everything from biomedicine to archaeology and all the fields in between, and versus the state of the culture, the state of education. I mean, 10 years ago, 12 years ago now, during the financial meltdown, Atlas Shrugged became one of a bestseller. People were saying, we're living in the novel now. But on the other hand, and I've wrestled with different ways of trying to understand this, but let me just ask Richard more of an economic question about it. We know that regulations, transfer payments, tax expropriations all diminish the ability of people in private business and private life to create value. But we've seen a huge amount of value created despite now a century or more of creeping government and accelerating government. So here's the question. I consider this dead weight on the dead weight being carried by the productive people. And my question is, how much dead weight can an economy, can the productive people who drive an economy, how much dead weight can they carry? When is there such a thing as the final straw on the camel's back that will just break it?
That's a great question, David. My quick answer would be no. That if we're looking for, I've seen these kind of scenarios over the years, you know, utter collapse, the wire breaks and the whole system crashes. It does happen sometimes, but not an entire system, even in the Soviet Union. You know, they very quickly and rapidly socialized and nationalized everything. And remember, and then there was like an immediate crash. And then Lenin went backward to the new economic policy. It was called NEP. And it was a move back toward capitalism for, I don't know, 5 years or so. And then they recovered. And then they said, well, we need to, I guess, slowly nationalize and socialize everything. We shouldn't do it quickly. Japan is another example. Japan, for 30 years now, I guess 30, yeah, since 1990, has gradually, slowly stagnated. There isn't any obvious, you know, crash or terrible period. There's a couple of periods here and there. But Japan, who the older ones in the room will remember, everyone was saying Japan in 1988. Oh, my gosh, Japan just going to surpass the United States. They're so this and that. And so they adopted a series of Keynesian interventionist policies and anti-capitalist policies, but it's stagnation rather than immediate collapse. So I think of it as not a heart attack, Dave. It's not, the analogy is not a heart attack, or it's a series of strokes, you know, not a one-off heart attack that puts the whole entity out of business, or a cancer. And that's what these are, the regs, the transfers, the taxes. When you said there's a century, it is true, yes, there's a century of this. And it's almost like you're saying, okay, why doesn't it just stop? Why didn't it just collapse under the weight of this thing? The answer to that also would be there are these periods of respites like the Reagan years, you know, where there are tax cuts or deregulation or less trust busting. And that helps the system survive a little bit as well, longer than it would otherwise. But that's my best answer to that. I think actually the look, the search for, or the expectation of, the dramatic event, the dramatic collapse, actually takes people's eyes off the ball of this longer term stagnation that occurs. And then that is definitely traceable in the numbers. Someone mentioned my essays at AIER. There's another one. If you go to that site, there is another one documenting the long-term slowdown in U.S. economic growth caused by the burden of government. So it's definitely noticeable in the numbers.
Thank you, Richard. That's really interesting. It's what we're dealing with is not a heart attack, but what something he used to be called a wasting disease.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And another way of looking at this is when you find crises and acute attacks on the, like the financial crisis, the first thing to look for is whether people attribute it to the statist elements in the mix, or whether they attribute it instead to the healthy elements, the capitalist elements. And although it's true that the financial crisis of 08-09 led to a boom in sales of Ayn Rand's books, the sad thing also is the probably 95% interpretation of that was Wall Street greed, deregulation, that kind of thing. They blame capitalism, not the government's policy of promoting home ownership to people who couldn't afford it. So that's very sad. It's like, well, there's a patient and they're having strokes, but the doctor is a quack and has no idea that the stroke, you know, that the stroke is due to drinking and smoking. He attributes the stroke to, you know, the guy's sex life and joy level. It's just, this is very sad.
Thanks.
This is John. One thing that, with reference to education, I was in another room a few days ago, and someone referenced American public education as the American Holocaust. And I thought that was a little bit extreme, but there's some accuracy to it. But then changing subjects, back to what you're talking about in terms of the economy, I think we're looking at the result of a chronic egalitarian mindset that is anti-achievement, it's anti-winners, it's anti-capitalist, it's anti-markets, it's the triumph of envy, it's the defeat of jealousy being the antonym of envy. Another thing that's going on is a failure to recognize the efficiency of markets and of, I think, biology as a source of history. I know this is a little different than philosophy or reason as a source of history or thinking. I think that the biology fundamental driver of history, perhaps not in an interesting way. And then with regard to regulation, I think that as frustrated envy. If I can't tax it and take it from you, then by gosh, I'll regulate it. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, John. The this particular issue of egalitarianism, and I will differ with you a little bit on some other interpretations, but another essay I wrote at AIER back in 2018 was called We Should Celebrate Diversity and Wealth Too. So the point I made in there was, in academia at least, there's lip service given to, we love diversity, we love variety, and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, except it's mostly having to do with skin color and genitals and things like that. But I also pointed out that it is somewhat celebrated in things like sports, arts and sciences, you know, the Academy Award, championships and stuff, but not in business. Why is diversity of performance and outcome, basically unequal outcomes, why aren't those celebrated in business? And I'm not going to go into the whole theory there, but some of it has to do with the physicalness of the performance. You see a basketball player like Michael Jordan performing, and you don't realize that his success enormously also has to do with his intelligence and how he manages his career and has discipline and stuff like that, all the virtues. It isn't just physicalist. And I think in a case of Trump, like, why relative to Romney was Trump celebrated and admired as a businessman, whereas Romney wasn't just qua businessman? Because Trump builds buildings that people can see and his name is on it. It's very concrete bound in a way. It is an achievement, but that's people's interpretation of it. What did Romney do? Venture capital, finance. People have no idea what finance is. This is a mystery to them. They don't think it's actually the production of wealth. So I think that's relevant as well. So the egalitarianism you're talking about, the idea of not equal treatment before the law, but we want equality of result. Yes, that is a real problem in terms of what people want, and but their egalitarian desires seem to be somewhat selective. The crazy part of the going on today, of course, is egalitarianism in literally physiology, in genitals and gender and things like that. But that's not my field. I'm just noticing it. Last thing on regulation, I think I have a different take on regulation. I mean, objectivists generally, capitalists generally are suspicious of regulation, but sometimes you see them speaking okay. You know, there's just like too much regulation, they'll say. I believe that a court system, which we uphold as a legitimate function of government, civil matters where there are damages and torts, a perfectly legitimate way of handling torts and wrongs and things like that with monetary settlements. The problem with the whole regulatory state is it violates jurisprudent assumption of innocent until proven guilty.
Agreed, 100%. Yes, yes.
The whole regulatory state assumes you're going to do bad and engages in what's called prior restraint. We assume you're going to hurt the consumer, therefore we will write a law ahead of time. But it's not just that. It also violates the principle of separation of powers of, you know, between executive, legislative, and judicial. The regulatory agencies, all the alphabet agencies have judge, jury, and executioner within. So it's wrong on, like, it's wrong on every level in terms of justice. But I think also part of the it's a necessary part of a system that is throwing out equality before the law. A system that's throwing that out or eroding it will necessarily have to substitute in its place the kind of rulemaking which is tyrannical.
Yes,
not just rulemaking.
And just going in the history of law, we had a situation when expert testimony was not allowed, was not admitted. And when things like proving that the guy up the river was the cause of killing the fish in your river below was impossible legally and also technically. And so with advances in science, technology, and if you will, regulatory science or causation, then the science of causation in pollution, your point about the administrative bureaucracy deferring to the courts and to juries and to people closer to the ground is excellent. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, John.
Clark, thanks for your patience. Clark, you want to unmute yourself? There you go.
Oh, yes, yes. Thank you, Jag. Thank you. Yeah, I guess just to cover the same territory, maybe from a slightly different angle, Richard. I'm just curious. I mean, you know, will the next recession be worse than the 07 and 08 one? And you know, I know you've kind of answered a lot of this already, but I mean, I guess I'm just very concerned that America is just not what, you know, we ain't what we used to be. We're not nearly as strong as, you know, the Great Depression almost 90 years ago. At least we had, you know, 100 years of freedom and prosperity and wealth creation, and, you know, the economy is just so sclerotic now that and all the stimulus and quantitative easing that's gone on, I think a lot of people just don't realize it's just we ain't what we used to be. And so I guess, you know, are we going to be like Weimar America, you know, if we do have another really great recession? And so I guess that's just to wrap up. I mean, how bad will it be? And, you know, I mean, will we turn the way Germany did 100 years ago to just, you know, the road to blood, toil, tears, and sweat?
Well, the one of the, just to stick to the, thank you, Clark, just to stick to the economics of it, one of the standout pathologies of Weimar was hyperinflation. So, I mean, quite apart from the corruption of the universities, which Peikoff and others documented in The Ominous Parallels and in other books, that has not occurred in the U.S. Yet. I mean, there was a hyperinflation during the Continental period before the Civil War, before the Revolutionary War. But the highest inflation experienced in the United States since, well, say in the last 100 years, there was a bit of it in World War One. It was something like 15 or 18%. But then it went back down and we went back on the gold standard. And then in the 70s, some of us will remember, it got as high as 14 or 15%. So now it's 8%. Well, that's not hyperinflation, but the only way to get to hyperinflation is through moderate inflation. You have to go through this period where there's moderate inflation. Now, here's what you asked, is the next recession going to be as bad as the past ones? It doesn't have to be, but here's what's definitely true. There are no balanced budgets anymore. There just aren't any. The last time that ever happened was 2000 to 2001 for about 3 or 4 years. And what that means is there is chronic deficit spending. And what that means is that there's chronic debt buildup. The U.S. debt's now $30 trillion, double what it was 10 years ago. That is a fast increase. And now the kicker really is if you can't fund the welfare state, the burgeoning welfare state, by taxes, because there'll be tax revolts, nor by borrowing a loan, then you resort to money printing. And the last three recessions in the U.S. have involved unprecedented amounts of money printing. It's just a fact. I mean, there were many, many recessions between World War II and 2000, but they did not involve gargantuan increases in the money supply. That did occur in 2000 when the Fed panicked about, what was it called? Y2K, remember the turn of the... Then they did it again after 9/11. They just printed money, just panicking. They did it again in 2008-09, feeling the financial system would collapse. They did it again under COVID, when the government, you know, mandated shutdowns of the economy, and yet people still had to pay their bills. So those are four in a row, four occasions in a row, where the Federal Reserve has so increased the money supply. Now, initially, we all know inflation didn't go up that much, because people were hoarding the money. So they were hoarding it as fast as the government was spending it. But now they're spending it, and that leads to a decline in the value of money. So, short answer to your question, it's not so much the next recession that worries me, although I prefer not to have recessions. It's the reaction to recessions now is to massively borrow and print money. And that will ultimately dissolve the dollar, and it'll make the dollar unreliable and unbelievable and incredible. And when currencies become that way, the cost of living skyrockets. People now are really hurt by a cost of living going up 8 to 12% a year. Imagine it going up 100% a year. It isn't impossible. The only thing holding it back is that the U.S. dollar still has a worldwide credibility. It's eroded enormously, but it still has relatively more credibility than most other currencies. But the historical parallel for this is the British currency. The British pound 100 years ago used to be widely respected, and then it was completely eroded and lost its credibility. So they went from going from Great Britain to plain old Britain. They lost the empire. They lost almost everything. So that is, it is possible for that to happen to the U.S. over the next 50 years.
Thank you. And we did get started a bit late. Richard, are you able to give us 10 more minutes in the room so that we'd have another 20 minutes to go?
That'd be great. I can do that, yes.
Okay. And I am going to get to Buck, but I do give precedence when we have our scholars or faculty in the room. So, Stephen Hicks, would you like to comment or ask a question.
Hi, just following up on David's question and the question of dead weight, whether the amount of ruin in a nation, we would reach a tipping point and it would collapse, recessions, depressions, and so on. So it's one thing to go through and say there's been an increase in various kinds of regulations, increase in dead weight and parasitism. But don't we also, and this is an economics question, have to measure that against the productivity gains? So to put it crudely, if we can say, you know, over the course of the last century, every year there's been on average an increase in 2% of dead weight, and that's bad. We can itemize all the ways in which the dead weight is wrong in principle, absolute and real costs. But if on average in that same stretch of time, productivity gains have been 3%, then there's going to be dislocations and bumps along the way, but we're still getting better. And we're never going to reach a point of collapse. And so then the question is going to be not over the course of the next, say, 10 years or 15 years, only that there's going to be an increase, say, in the absolute amounts of dead weight, but whether that absolute amount of dead weight is greater or less than the anticipated gains to productivity over that same period of time.
Stephen, I think that's a perfectly fine way of looking at it and a perfectly fine way of explaining why the context matters, that while dead weight costs rise and maybe at varying rates, so does productivity. I guess the thing I would say is that the gap between the two and is what I've noted is narrowing, so that whereas, say, 50 years ago, the productivity gains might be 4% a year, and the dead weight is, you know, one. Now the productivity gains are, you know, 3% a year, and the dead weight is two. So the margin is shrinking, and of course there's an interrelationship between the two. The dead weight, regulations, taxation, inflation erode the capital base, and that's the origin of productivity. I mean, aside from the mind, the creative brainiacs giving us productivity gains, the base of it is capital equipment, the quality of capital equipment. And it's not as if that's stagnating, but it is growing at a lesser rate than it used to. So, but I agree with you. That would be one way of looking at how can this keep going? Well, one answer would be you can't look only at dead weight losses. I think another thing I would say, Stephen, is people underestimate how clever producers are, not just at producing, but at evading, in a good sense, evading regulations and burdens. So, I mean, some of this has to do with hiring tax attorneys and accountants and what Ayn Rand used to call bodyguards, you know, from Washington. But over the years, the more I study this and I see regulation going up with this and that, I'm impressed at how it's unfortunate they have to spend time doing this. But the producers, some of them are equally clever, or they have assistants clever at, you know, moving their capital around to avoid some of these deadweight burdens and losses. And it isn't just a matter of, you know, lobbying for special favors and things. It's more, call it evasive action, so that they can keep producing. There are many dramatizations of this in Atlas, actually. But you know what? Eventually, though, you can't escape it when it becomes totalitarian. Right now, it's not totalitarian, and so there are pockets of, you know, action where you can say, "Well, I'm going to move my money around and get away from this burden." And that's, I think, another thing that keeps the system going.
All right, thank you, Buck. Appreciate your patience. Do you have a question for Professor?
Yes, I do. Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to ask this question to some scholars, because I must confess my understanding of objectivism is more colloquial than academic. One of the things that I notice when I frequent rooms and listen to folks who describe themselves as objectivists is that they're quite comfortable with monopolies as long as they are not the product of government intervention or the government itself. And it strikes me as problematic in that the value of markets is the ability to trial different strategies and to detect information from the market. And I think that is lost when you have monopolies or heavy consolidation. So can I ask, am I wrong in that understanding that, you know, monopoly busting is sort of anathema to objectivism, or is that part of making sure that that function of markets has the integrity and vibrancy that we need?
Well, in the objectivist literatures, there's extensive and I think justified criticisms of antitrust, and not just criticisms of it application, but it should be abolished. I agree with that entirely. I think the entire, going now to the economics of it, the entire theory of monopoly is wrong. And some of it is Marxist oriented, but instead of just getting into name calling, the theory is that there is a necessary profit motive in becoming huge. Now, in economics, you'll learn that there's something called economies of scale, scale meaning size, wherein the bigger you become, the lower your unit costs. And if you can lower your unit costs, you can lower the price you charge to customers and still be profitable, all leading to the idea that there's going to be mass production and mass affordability, and bigness becomes, well, I'm big because I have a huge satisfied customer base. Well, so far I'm thinking, what's the problem with any of that? And if mono means one, there are actually very rare cases of this, but we might as well defend the few that we see. Alcoa is a perfect example. Alcoa became 95%, I think, at one point of the aluminum market. Now, the standard view in economics is the monopolist is price gouging, charging whatever the hell they want, restricting output. That's not what Alcoa did. And Standard Oil and all the other cases, Microsoft, IBM, all the other cases in the history almost to a case show massive increases in output by these companies, lowering of price because they could lower unit costs. And the opposite of the principles of economies of scale are diseconomies of scale, meaning sometimes companies get too big. They become unwieldy. Sometimes they'll become conglomerates, and they'll go the other way and start breaking up precisely because they're not profitable at some level. So there's an optimal size of companies, you know, having to do with, their surrounding context. But so I don't want to say too much more on that. I don't want to take up the whole thing. But one last thing, there is still, believe it or not, in microeconomics, a Platonic notion of perfect competition. And the perfect competition model basically is anti-competitive. It doesn't allow for winners of competitions. It wants every company to be small. Many companies, small market shares, no pricing power, no above normal profits, no barriers to entry. It's a totally egalitarian, not just Platonic in the sense of unreal, a totally egalitarian standard for what competition should look like. And that drives and motivates a lot of the trust busting as well. So there's bad philosophy, not just bad economics, at the root of this. Government monopolies certainly should not be allowed, but those are the ones that are really abusive, the ones where government gives special favors, franchise, and privileges to certain companies. But if it's earned on a free market, the history has been that these are great companies and shouldn't be trust busted.
Professor, that was excellent. Thank you.
Thanks, Buck. Thank you, Buck.
Okay, we're going to take a couple more questions. Thank you, Professor Salzman, for staying a little longer with us. And again, apologies for the technical difficulties we had earlier on. Meike, hope I'm not mispronouncing your name.
Oh, I like the French pronunciation. Thank you. It's Meike.
Meike, okay.
So thank you so much for this, this space. And Professor Salzman, for this question. My question to you is, I have a unique perspective over the economy. I'm in wealth management, Houston, Texas, where everyone is a millionaire, and we work with a lot of ultra high net worth clients. So when I hear people compare this economy to 2008, first of all, being home to AIG, I understand what happened there. So can you kind of explain a little bit about why people tend to compare this to 2008, especially in terms of what is happening with the stock market? Because from our perspective, we have people that are literally sitting on millions of dollars in cash because the corporations made out like a bandit in those 2 years after that Q1 2020 with COVID. And we basically have people just looking for income. There's so much liquidity in the market right now because people are holding on to cash. So I would just like to hear from your perspective why that comparison still persists when, in my opinion, there really is no comparison, especially with all the growth from the past 2 years, even with inflation in the market, playing Russian roulette, no pun intended, on a daily basis. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Miki. I'm not sure why people are paralleling the two, but if I were to pick one common element, and this was true at the end of 99 as well, when the stock market was doing well, whenever the stock market does very well, there are people on all sides, not just Keynesians and socialists, but Austrian economists or free market economists. They think it's a bubble. They call it a bubble. Meaning, and the analogy, of course, is an unsustainable, inflated thing about to pop. And then say, I don't believe in bubbles. I don't think that markets are stupid and easily fooled into overpaying for stuff. Self-interest says pay what you can, but don't overpay. Now, it's not that markets don't go up and then crash. My theory is they crash when government imposes punitive policies. And then we could debate what those are, whether it's monetary, tax, regulatory, or whatever. But that is the only thing I could name as to why people might say, before this year began, hey, it's a bubble. It's unsustainable. It's too high. And when they see Miki, I think when they see it accompanied by money printing, now that is the plausible complaint. If it's going up and at the same time the government is printing a lot of money, they put two and two together and say bubble. So that could be why. But of course, they would say, well, it just went down 30%. So I must have been right. Look, it went down 30% in the last 5 months. So I was right. The bubble is popping. I would just leave it at this. I'm in the same business you are. I am in academia, but I also run an investment research and consulting firm. So I'm talking with investors and writing for them all the time as well. My impression over the last two decades has been that the more the government intervenes in the economy, and all sides of the spectrum agree that it's doing so, they only differ on whether they endorse it or not, I do think it makes people justifiably say the stock market is not connected to reality. It's not connected to the economy. Because there's so much manipulation going on that it can't be. Then the only question is they can't figure out how disconnected it is. Now, I actually think this is a good thing, because if people thought government intervention and manipulations were good and not causing a disconnect, then I would be even more worried. But they mostly realize that there's a disconnect. So I think that's the other thing. You've probably noticed if you're in this business, it becomes more and more difficult to gauge the valuation of stocks and things like that when public policy is so arbitrary and capricious.
Thank you so much for that explanation. Super appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Miki. Thank you.
All right. Jordan, we're so honored to have you in the room. You'd like to unmute and chime in?
Thank you, Jennifer. Yeah, I was formulating my question based on the blog post, but I lost it. So I hate to yield to someone else, but I sent you a message to see if I could get that, because that was kind of part of my question, but I hadn't read the whole thing.
Okay, I'll shoot it to you on the back channel.
Thank you. And you can yield to someone else. Thanks.
JP.
Thank you, Jennifer. I prepared my question this morning as soon as I realized that there was going to be an AMA this morning. For full disclosure, I have a talk to give on the subject matter on Monday, so this is why I wanted to pick an objectivist brain. Richard, if you have one, what is your take, or anyone here on the potential of the blockchain technology for civilizational change. Many scholars equate it to the impact of the internet and government and governance being among the top high applications for it. Thank you.
Well, thank you, JP. This is somewhat of a technical question, and I would refer you to, if you go to the Atlas Society website in the past events, I did interview a couple of brainiacs on crypto and blockchain and other things. So for a deeper discussion, more detailed discussion of that, I'd highly recommend that. I specifically interviewed a fella named Jack Kreisel, K-R-I-E-S-E-L, on one of my Moles and Markets seminars. I would just say this quickly, because it's probably too technical for the audience. I don't believe, even though I'm impressed by technological advances like this, I don't believe at the end of the day, if it's an impediment to a government that wants to seize more power, that it will survive. That same thing happened with the gold standard. It was a wonderful, great monetary system. But to the extent it got in the way of the U.S. government wanting to, you know, have profligate finance, it just got rid of the gold standard. It's not the gold standard failed on its own. And the gold standard was not something that institutionally could handcuff the government. If the government wanted to get it out or get rid of it, it did. And I think the same would happen to the blockchain and the whole crypto space. If it's something that helps us liberate ourselves payment-wise and otherwise from statist regimes, that's good as so far as it goes. But if these statist regimes really want to crack down on it, criminalize it, it can do so. So I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
Thanks, JP.
Okay. Jordan, I don't know if you got the article and if you had enough time to take a look at it.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, and thank you. This is a fascinating conversation, and thank you, Richard. I had recently interviewed Imran Khan's ex-wife, the former prime minister of Pakistan, and it was fascinating. We were talking about, and maybe this is such a dramatic shift here, but it was fascinating to me with regard to the cronyism in politics, and obviously the blatant corruption. But there was an article mentioning work by or a survey from Transparency International that really pointed out much of what is discussed in the article. And I didn't really have a specific question for you, but was just going to comment on that. And I hadn't quite finished the article, but thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Jordan. Just quickly, Transparency International is where I got in my essay, which I think Jag earlier linked to, on rent selling and corruption. Transparency does have a corruption index, and it's not perfect, but it's better than nothing, and they rank all the countries of the world by level of corruption. And in that essay, I basically, with data and showing graphs, interpreted corruption as related to how much government intervention there was in the economy, and there's a direct relationship. So there are, Cato and others have measures of economic freedom, and the countries with less economic freedom can be interpreted as there's a bigger mix of statism in the economy, right? Well, there's a correlation between that and corruption. So corruption tends to go up as government intervention in the economy goes up. And so I think that is... I think that's an important way of looking at it. If you can put numbers to this, it makes more sense to people.
Thank you.
Okay, last, definitely not least, Roger, we've missed you. It's good to have you back in the room.
Yeah, no, I've been busy. I'm currently with over 1,000 libertarians hanging out in Reno at the Libertarian Convention. What I wanted to ask, and I'm glad you guys are doing this right now, is... when it comes to, you were talking earlier about, you know, the economy and inflation, and you mentioned Austrian, you know, economists and their take on some of this stuff. I have a question on, like, why is the Austrians the only school of free market economics that people now want to embrace? Like, where did Chicago school fall out of favor? Is it just because of Milton Friedman instituting the payroll deduction tax, or is there more to it? And is there a chance for the Chicago school to bounce back?
Well, that's a great question, Roger. By the way, in the future, when I've been saying, ask me anything, it's too broad. In the future, I'll do ask me anything about capitalism, ask me anything about Austrian economics. It could get too narrow. We might have three people in the room, but no, it's an important point. I would name the top, in the last 50 years, the four or five free market schools in academia. Austrian, which is not the biggest market share, Chicago, you mentioned Chicago and the monetarism, supply side, which was really not an academic thing, but a popular thing, and rational expectations. Now, I think the only reason Chicago faded was because Friedman mostly promoted the idea of monetarism, and monetarism more narrowly says the inflation rate will go up as much as the money supply, and that didn't happen in the 80s and 90s, and it was totally discredited. I mean, it's sad to say, actually, because Friedman's a giant, but he used to say, if my predictions are no good, I don't have a scientific theory. And they did predict, the monetarists and Friedman, that with the money supply going up in the 80s and 90s, they predicted very, very high inflation, and it went the opposite. So some of it was they just shot themselves in the foot by holding out prediction as the sine qua non of whether it was a science or not. Supply side, I'm a supply sider. I am a big advocate of Art Laffer, Bob Mundell, and the whole supply side group. And they used to fight with the monetarists because the monetarists were against the gold standard and the supply siders were for the gold standard and various other things having to do with tax rates. But as you know, the supply side thing is ridiculed as trickle down, is ridiculed precisely because it works so well, I think, frankly. And that it was focused on entrepreneurs and moneymakers and things like that, and said, stop punishing them, stop taxing them. That the Laffer curve effectively is an Atlas Shrugged theme, that when you punish the producers, they disappear. So I'm not sure I would agree with your original comment that the Austrians are the only ones heralded today. I don't know who heralds them, that they're not, they deserve more heralding, I suppose, but they're not widely endorsed, so far as I can tell. Maybe you're just saying within the libertarian movement, Roger.
Yeah, within my circle, that seems to be, you know, everyone wants to follow in Milton Friedman's son's footsteps and Murray Rothbard and consider themselves an ANCAP. But yet when you walk them through their actual belief system, they're a minarchist through and through. But I digress.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone. Also, just wanted to let you know, I think we had a question on cryptocurrency, and I put a link up there to an interview I did a while back with Michael Saylor. And if we have any Michael Saylor fans, then please sign up for updates at the Atlas Society. We have some very big news coming up about Michael Saylor. So thank you, everybody. Appreciate the patience that you've had with us today and with Clubhouse today. Hope to see you tomorrow. Professor Jason Hill is going to be back on with part two, The Moral Defense of Elitism and Meritocracy. And we have a big week next week. We've got an Ask Me Anything with Rob Krasinski. Also another one with Professor Stephen Hicks. And then I'm going to be interviewing Spencer Jacob on Wednesday. He's written about the GameStop frenzy and helping us gain insight into what happened there. So again, appreciate it, everyone, and hope to see you tomorrow.
Jennifer, may I add just one thing?
Yeah, please.
Tonight, Morals and Markets, if you know students, if you know of a student who would be interested in listening to this, 8 o'clock Eastern tonight till 9:30, my Morals and Markets session will be on economic sanctions, whether economic sanctions work, whether they're moral, proper, all that kind of thing. So so I just wanted to plug that.
Okay, I'm going to put that link up there. Didn't plug it because I know we are trying to really try to get more young people in that room.
Yep.
So if you are do not fall into that category. Please, you're welcome to come and audit, but please just keep your camera off. So thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thanks, everyone.